Welcome back to everybody. It is so good to be learning again. Now we have fewer interruptions. What we're going to have is a Thanksgiving interruption at the end of the month. But other than that, we really have a straight path. And so it's very exciting to be able to get places. We have a lot to cover. And tonight is going to be the fourth parak of Shmuel. But actually, it is also, I would say, is perhaps a time to entitle it Dealing with Loss. If you think about this parak over here. Why? Because, you know, sometimes we wonder to ourselves, how is it that the Torah is always constant, is always present, is always relevant to us? You know, the Torah doesn't sort of, you know, step out of character and say to us at certain points, you know, when you're going through such and such, this is what you should be feeling. The Torah doesn't explicitly say that. So how does the Torah guide us in highs, lows, and in-betweens? So what it does is that, remember, there were many, many, many prophecies throughout the ages. Not all of them. In fact, most of them were not recorded in the books that we have. The 24 books of Tanakh we have are specifically that which was recorded, which was relevant then and now. And so when we read it, we're not just reading what happened in a historical account of a particular episode that happened in the mid-Judean mountains. We're talking about something which is actually relevant in a psychological, in a real sense, what's going on right now. So when we study this chapter together, this particular parak Shmuel Aleph, Perek Dalet, I would like to think about, I think the topic of the Perek is dealing with loss. And we're going to deal with a very big loss, which is experienced in this Perek on many levels, on a theological, on a personal level, on so many levels. And the Tanakh is going to describe to us how people integrate that, how people deal with that. And perhaps what we have to understand is the narrator lauding such behavior or not? Meaning, we're going to see perhaps some of the incorrect responses to tragedy, which is going to be described over here, and it's very, very relevant to us. I'd be interested, I know that we have a few psychologists and psychiatrists in the audience, so it'd be interesting to hear the responses from a psychological perspective of how the Tanakh describes it right over here. So without much further ado, let's try to get a sense of this. We'd like to just start again. We're going to start in the text just for the first few psukim, and then we're going to reflect section by section. So the first section over here is the first two psukim, which set into motion this perek. Okay, this is in the section which with the actual text of Shmuel. So don't need to worry about it. The Tanakh tells us, "Vayhi devar Shmuel lechol Yisrael." Shmuel's word was to all of Israel. "Vayetze Yisrael likras plishtim lamilchama," and Israel went out to wage war against the Philistines. They are now the predominant foe from now on inwards. "Vayachanu al ha'even ha'ezer uplishtim chanu ba'afek." So the Jews are, or the Israelites are encamped by this Even Ha'ezer, and the Philistines are on the opposite side, Ba'afek. They're in the southeast. Southwest. "Vayarachu plishtim likras Yisrael, vatitosh ha'milchama, vaynogef Yisrael lifnei plishtim, vayakub b'maracho ha'basadeh, k'arba'as alofim ish." Israel encounters their first loss in battle. They lose 4,000 men on the field. So just to put these things in perspective, sometimes you just read words. What was the tally or the death toll for 9/11? It was 2,996, including the people on the planes as well, and including the Pentagon side of things. So you know that, I mean, that's like, you know, in our lifetime, if you think about, you know, something which was like, you know, of immense proportions and losses, you have to imagine this is more than that. That's already another 25% more than that. And also, if you think about it, it's, you know, it wasn't in one boom. You know, in those days in the battlefield, you know, it had to be done person by person. You know, we're talking about a really terrible tragedy of 4,000 people being killed on the battlefield. This is a really gruesome massacre which has occurred. So we're really talking about something which is horrifying. Now, there's actually a very big problem in these two psukim. There's a theologically troubling issue with the way this is described. What is that? There's something very problematic with this terrible horror, this terrible description of our loss in battle here. What is wrong in this picture?
God's not
perfect. Okay, so we don't have God explicitly mentioned over here. That's fine. Meaning, okay, so maybe it's in the absence of God's purview, so to speak. Right. Meaning, God sort of stepped out to allow this to happen. But what else?
The Israelites were attacking them.
So the Israelites are attacking, which is fine. But that's fine because we've seen the Israelites attacking, and they've attacked on the right. They're on the right course beforehand. There's something else going on over here, which is a problem. So we're going to deal with the ark in a second, but you're coming with outside information, without even outside information, just in these psukim. Why are they going out to battle, does it sound like? What was that?
Doesn't say.
Yeah, so Shmuel told him to.
So, you know, Don is making a good point over here. is that it sounds like Shmuel's telling them to go out to battle. And what do they go out to? They go out to meet their deaths.
Right?
So in the way these two psukim are set up over here, it sounds like what's being described is the prophet of God, the newly initiated prophet of God, is telling the nation of Israel, go out into this battle, raise your swords, raise your spears, and they go out to their doom. Now, if it would be a military leader who made a mistake, okay, military leaders make mistakes, we'll depose of him and we'll replace him, that's fine. But when you talk about the prophet of God, that's more of a problem, right? How could it be that Shmuel is allowing this to happen on his watch? This is the first time it sounds like he's addressing Israel. Jesse, what do you think?
But I don't understand why it's a problem, because we sometimes have to go do things that don't have a positive outcome, and there's a bigger picture there.
But Jesse, the things that you're thinking about, I think you're right. But I think the things would be like this, is we have destinations to get to in life. Sometimes those destinations take us through thorn bushes. And sometimes there's victims getting through those thorn bushes. I get that. But Shmuel's not telling them that. Shmuel's telling them to go out over the precipice. And so it's not like there's a destination they're trying to get to. And by the way, he is telling them to walk into the lion's jaws, which is going to be an eventual destruction. Do you see the difference as opposed to the means of the ends? It's theologically disconcerting how it could be that he is telling them to walk into their imminent deaths. Unless he's not telling them. Right. Unless he's not telling them. What other options do we have over here?
He didn't tell them.
Maybe he didn't tell them. Maybe he wasn't speaking. So it could be they misunderstood what he was saying. But let's go even further. Did Shmuel talk about battles? Or that would end in demise beforehand? So if we go back to Perek Gimel, remember that the dream, Shmuel's first prophecy at night, was that on the day that terrible calamity is going to occur, that's when the curse of Eli is going to take effect. So maybe what's happening over here, this is exactly what Rashi says over here, this is just important in terms of framing our Perek over here. Take a look at the Rashi, just on our supplement for 2.4, capture of the ark. Rashi says, Vayidvar Shmuel l'chol Yisrael, Nia davar shenemar l'shmuel. What Shmuel heard about now occurred. Right, uval kol Yisrael, and it came to all of Israel. How did it happen? Because the nation of Israel walked out to wage war. Which means we're not being described a command and a response. Where now Tanakh is sort of stepping in as the narrator and saying, "Look, as you watch them running out into battle, remember the echo of that vision at night that Shmuel had, that there's going to be this terrible calamity which is about to come." And so what's happening is we, the reader, are hearing that deafening music of destruction of the words of Shmuel as we watch them running out on their horses with their swords ready to attack their enemies. So the Tanakh is not describing Shmuel's command, it's rather describing the very terrible sort of, we'll call it, you know, bigger perspective of what's going on over here, which is a terribly sad thing over here, but it's ultimately Shmuel's restitution as a Navi rather than his undermining. So anyway, so this is...
Could you tell me where that is?
Sure, let's get the actual pasuk in themselves.
Yeah.
Let me just actually identify the exact pasuk over here. It's in Perek Gimel. Let me just see where it is. Yeah, it's Yud Aleph and Yud Beis in Perek Gimel. Something's going to happen in Israel that anybody who hears about it, their ears are going to ring. Terrible calamity is going to befall. And on that day, I'm going to make the curse come to his house. So what's this terrible thing that Shmuel was told about? So all the Mephoreshim say what's about to occur in the next parak, which is this needless loss of life, which is going to occur in the battle. Okay, so Shmuel's a nevuah of destruction is now actually coming into action. So now, what happens? So now we have, this is the moment where we can sort of take a breath and now collect ourselves. So let's imagine that we were among that first war host and we survived that battle. What do we do now? Right, so what would you do? You've just suffered a terrible loss. You can't imagine the army could have been hundreds of thousands thick. It could have been, maybe. But it's still 4,000 people. It's a lot of people. Okay, so what do you do now? How do you regroup? What are you going to tell the troops? So listen to the response of Israel. Let's take their full response from Pasuk Gimel to Hay. These three psukim. Vayavo amal el machne. They return to the camp. Vayomer zignei Yisrael lama nigafnu Hashem lifnei haplishtim. Why did God cause us to be hit, smitten in front of the Philistines? Nikcha eleinu mishiloi es Aron bris Hashem v'yovo b'kirbeinu v'yoshia v'yoshien mikafoven. So as Anna was pointing out, let's bring the Ark of the Covenant into the battle, and we will be saved from our enemies. And they went and they got the Ark of the Covenant, and they brought it out. The two sons of Eli, of course, were there because they were the people, the custodians. And as the Aaron enters into the camp of Israel, everybody starts crying out this loud cry, and everything becomes confused. There's this fear, which sort of everybody who hears this from the sides, this large war cry, which is coming out. And this is what they do. You know, it's like it reminds you, Al-Havdil, the Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, it's, you know, anyone who has this on their side, their enemies will melt, right? You know, you can sort of like, you imagine the scene over here as it comes in there. They must have been reading the Bible very carefully when they made that movie. And so we have this, you know, this is going to be the game changer. We're all set to go now, right? This is what we have over here. Now, there's a few things to notice over here that are going on. First of all, why are they crying out? Let's just sort of try to understand what's going on in the psychology of the people in the camp here. Why are the people who they're sitting there, suddenly runs and goes and gets the Aaron, and now they're standing by? Why are they crying out? What kind of cry is this?
I think it's going to protect them.
Okay, so it's a cry of
happy.
Of, so it may be some sort of happiness, exhilaration, triumph, maybe, or maybe unhatched triumph, right? Because they think this is it. We're going to now succeed. Happens to be, Marjorie.
It's like going to war.
Right, it could be a war cry, right? So the cry of war, like the angry, or the soldiers now, like, you know,
rallying
call of let's take it. Now we have everything we need. Let's run into battle. So this is, you can sort of imagine the scene which is being set over here. So what happens? And by the way, just graphically, you know, for those who have had opportunity to you know, watch movies like Lord of the Rings. So, you know, today, with the graphics they have today, you can really actually see what it means to have an army of that size. It's very hard to imagine this, but when you have an army of 10,000 and you hear them all stamping their feet and the ground shakes, you know, that kind of, you can imagine this kind of scene being created over here, and this is their war cry, and they're about to drive in, and you think, wow, this is it. Now, there's a few problems over here. First of all, it happens to be in early in Tanakh, there is an almost similar circumstance where the Aaron is coming with the people and there's this large cry. Very similar circumstance. It happens to be that the first conquest Israel actually makes in the land of Israel is almost identical. Take a look in the next source in Yoshua, Perek Zion. They are approaching the city of Jericho, Yericho, and this is what Yoshua says to them. Vayomer Hashem al Yoshua, God says to Joshua, Re'ein osati b'yodcha es Yericho ves malka v'gibor echal. God says, Yeshua, I got this one covered. I'm going to give it all to you. For 6 days, all your soldiers are going to encircle the city one time for 6 days. And then you'll have the Kohanim leading, and the Ark of the Covenant, which is going to be circling, and they're going to blow on their shofars. When everybody hears the blowing of those horns following the Aaron, then everybody will cry out. And then the walls will immediately fall, and the cry of the people, the walls of the enemy, which the fortified city of Jericho, the impenetrable city, will be now penetrable, and now the battle will ensue without any unfair advantage to the people living inside. And that's what's happening over here. So what's going through these people's minds? They remember that their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents told them that there was this time in Israel where God stepped in and the Ark of the Covenant came out from its abode and walked in front of the battle, and everybody cried out. And what happened? The enemy fell and melted in front of them. So what's happening over here in the collective memory of Israel is they're recreating that moment where Hashem was miraculously with them. The problem is over here is what's missing in our text that is unlike Yoshua. God is not talking. Who is talking over here? Who are the speakers in this particular instance, in our case? The elders, right? The people, in fact, we don't have any consultation with Eli at all. Eli happens to be a side figure as a descriptive figure over here. We don't have any Eli or Urim Batumim being consulted. We don't even have Shmuel being consulted. Shmuel sort of the we'll call the harmony, that terrible harmony at the back that we're hearing of that prophecy, what's about to happen. But we don't hear any consultation. They're running in head first into this battle, recreating in an organic sense what was really success before, but not necessarily now. So, you know, the part of it is over here is that there's no leadership, or real leadership. But more than that, there's something else which is far more concerning with what's going on over here, and that is the following. If we look at this generation over here, not only is it that Hashem is not with them, we know a few things about this generation. In fact, we know number one is that they're a generation that although they have a Mishkan, they have God's tent of meeting, they also have parallel to it in the Har Ephraim. They have another shrine, and that's called Pesel Micha. We've dealt with that a lot last year. There is this shrine, this idolic shrine, which is now parallel to the Mishkan. So, spiritual state, good, bad, neutral, pretty bad, right? On a whole, nationally, they're not doing so well. More than that, we're going to see later on in Perek Zion, when we get to that in 2 or 3 weeks' time, we're going to see that Shmuel himself is going to say to the nation, when he sort of addresses them and redresses them, he says, you remove all your gods, all your idolatrous forms, which means to say that the people over here are not the people with the cleanest slates. So when tragedy hits, what should their response have been? What should the Zakenim have said when considering why they lost this battle? So they should have taken a very careful look in the mirror. They should have said, well, maybe we shouldn't be going out to battle again. Maybe there's something we need to correct in society. Maybe there's something that we as a nation... Now remember, this is hard because we don't think in these terms today. We sort of think very much in an individualistic sense, right? We think, each individual, we ask why on each individual, and you're right. That there's a lot to be thinking about on that. But on a collective sense, which is the way Tanakh usually views things, is as a collective sense, they should have taken a very piercing look in that mirror and said, what's going on? Why is there a Pesel Micha? Why are there so many shrines? What's going on as a nation over here? What level of corruption is our society? That should have been their response. But instead, what do they do? What's happening over here? Their problem lies where? Where's their problem? Their problem is outside of themselves, right? Meaning, if only we could have the shrine of God, if only we could have the Ark of the Covenant come with us in battle, then our problems would be solved. Now, this is actually really interesting as to what's going on here, the real tragedy of what's happening. This actually links to a very beautiful thought in Parshas Noach, which I really wanted to share with you at the same time, because it's really something which is so profoundly human as to what's going on over here, and we do it every day. So you see that what happens over here is, let me just actually pull out, I have a chumash right here. Unplanned, but I wanted to just mention this is a very, very, very powerful point. The end of last week's parasha, Bereishis, we're told why Noach is named Noach. Okay, Noach is the name of our parasha, and he has this very powerful name. Noach literally means some sort of comfort. Okay, some sort of comfort is Noach's name. So it's a beautiful name to have. Menachem is very similarly related to that. Okay, so to comfort. Listen to what his father said. So Lemech, who is his father, has him at the age of 82 and says, "Vayikra Shmoy Noach." Remember, people lived very long in those days. So he called his name Noach Lemor, saying, "Zeya Nachamenu, this child will comfort us, mima'asenu, from our actions, umi'itzvon yodenu, and from the sadness of our hands, mina adama asher eroro Hashem, from the ground which God had cursed." That sounds fabulous, right? That's great. This is our salvation boy. This is going to be the boy who's going to change society. Everything that was difficult up till now is going to be comforted. And Noach represented that sense of hope, which is beautiful, right? The only thing is that there's a little bit of a problem in this description. And that is if you look at the tools of this sentence over here, there's a very troubling conclusion. Let's look at the words that were used in the sentence. Zeya Nachamenu, this boy, the first word to notice is Nechama. This boy is our Nechama, our change or our comfort. From what? Mima Asenu, from our actions, word number two. And from what? Umi Itzon Yadenu, and from the sadness of our hands, word number three. Because, why? Because the curse that God placed Me'al Pnei Adama, on the face of the earth. Okay, so Noach as our nechama from two things, ma'asim of our ma'asim and our Yisrael Yodeinu, on the ground. Okay, this is what Noach is representing. Great. The problem is if you move six psukim later, and we talk about God's decision to destroy humanity, which is now what's happening in our parasha, in parashas Noach itself, this is the end of parashas Bereishis, listen to the words that God uses. God says the following. God sees that people are bad all the time. Okay, humanity is not doing, living up to their standards. God also changes his mind. Now this nechama doesn't mean comfort, it means a change, a regret of sorts. So God changes his mind. Ki asa esa adam, that he created man. This is not man's work, but God's work he's now changing his mind about. God grew upset in his heart. This is an anthropopathism. We're putting pathos into God. And what does he say? I'm going to wipe humanity off the face of the ground. Is that crazy? It's the same four descriptions, right? Nechama, ma'asim, itzvon yodeinu, and me'al pnei adama. It's almost like what God is saying is that because Lemech named his son this name, I'm going to destroy humanity. And he uses the same language as Lemech when naming his son. Now that's crazy. What's going on over here? Why would God be so... If humanity is doing bad, then okay, wipe them out because they're not living up to what they're supposed to be doing. But why is because of Noach? Dina's in, should be smiling right now because we're all talking about what's going on over here is David Foreman has the most beautiful idea, which is actually on 3 years ago on Aleph Beta. If you're interested in seeing it, really worthwhile looking. And this is it's exactly the problem we're talking about in Shmuel Aleph Perik Dalet, which is going on over here. This is the following. Rashi explains that what was it about Noach that Lemech was so inspired about? He saw prophetically, says Rashi, that Noach would be anthropologically the creator of the plow. Right, so Noach would be, in history, he would be at the advent of the next stage of technology of the plow. Now, how does that help humanity? Because, what was the curse? So the curse of at least man was that because of what happened in Eden, there's going to be korts v'dardor tatzmiach lach, you're going to have all these terrible thorns, and the earth's not going to yield its bezeis apecha toichalechem. Right, you're going to have this, there's a disconnection between your work and the outcome of what the earth is going to yield. And in fact, when Cain and Hevel sin, when Cain kills Hevel, then Hashem sort of compounds that further. Lo soy seif, that Hashem says the earth is not going to carry on giving you its strength. The curse is compounded further into the relationship of humans qua earth. So now what happens? So Noach arrives, and what does he bring about? He brings about a plow. You know what the problem is? Is that the reason why there was a gap in the relationship was because God wanted us to move our way backwards towards Him. He distanced us from Him and the earth because He wanted the relationship with us. So what do humans do? What do humans do? They say, well, we're in a state of discomfort. We're in a state that's very uncomfortable to live in. So what do? We'll take a Tylenol. We'll get rid of the discomfort. We have a plow, right? We don't have to worry about this. God put us in a very difficult situation. It's not about the relationship with God because we can get rid of the symptoms. Yeah. Right? We can now live a happy-ish kind of life. You know, it's still not easy. Plows don't help everything. But at least we can make it a little easier. Says God, if that's the way we're dealing with the relationship, if you're using technology to address a theological crisis, a crisis in relationship, then they're not worth carrying on. Then the experiment is ended. Says Hashem, if that's why you find comfort, or how you find comfort, is where you're moving away from the reason why there was a break in the relationship. Think what's going on over here. The people come back from the battle. God is now trying to give them a very clear message. What do they say? You know what it was? We forgot the Aaron. That's what it was. It's just a formula. If we bring that box into the camp, boom, we'd win the war. You see what's happening over here? They're deflecting. Where the problem in the relationship is to somewhere else. It's outside of themselves. Then this is what happens over here. But just to take this a little further, the Mishnei Chochma, Rav Meir Simcha Devinz describes, he talks about very fascinatingly, if just to the last level of appreciation of this, is when Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from Har Sinai in Parashat Kisisa, as described, he walks down the mountain, he sees the people have sinned. What's the first thing that Moshe Rabbeinu does upon seeing them? is he throws down these the luchos and the tablets, and they are destroyed. And you think to yourself, you know, we're told the story, we grew up with the story, and we learned it in kindergarten, and we learned it again and again and again, and it's all very fine. But in the end of the day, how did he have the license to do that? You know, like, who gave you the license to destroy God's handiwork? Do you know what I'm saying? God just gave you it's not like the world which God created way back and we're kind of living in, and we kind of, you know, turn a blind eye when we're destroying it, right? This God wrote, right? This is God's writ, which is coming down to humanity, and the first thing you do is you destroy it. And in fact, Hashem congratulates him. He made the right move, but really? How did he know? Was there a little note on the back that said, you know, just in case? Like, what's going on over here? So this is an Ishah Chochmah, an unbelievable thing. And that is that J.J. Schachter always points out this Ishah Chochmah. In fact, he quoted it briefly when he was here as well. And that is, he says, a really shocking, shocking thing. And that is that all Kedusha in this world is actually dependent Kedusha. All holiness in this world is not intrinsic, but rather dependent. Which means to say that even when you think to yourselves, wow, there's certain things in the world which are holy. You know, you have shuls, you have Torahs, you have books, you have sanctuaries. They're all holy. And the Mishnah Chochmah says, no. Everything which is holy is dependent on the way it's treated. If you empty it out, if you're not treating it in the way that it is appropriate to be treated, then he says, and the words he used to describe, I put it into the sources, but we're not going to read inside, but he just says, is that those were empty, lenivlei cheres, those were empty pieces of rock, the luchos. Moshe Rabbeinu did not destroy the luchos. The luchos had long left. When Israel sinned, those were no longer holy. He was simply breaking marble or rock at the bottom of the mountain there. Is that a shocking idea? So you say to yourself, well, look what's happening over here. They're bringing out the Aron. How can't they lose? And the answer is, they're not bringing anything out to battle. What's happened? They don't have a relationship with God. There is no relationship going on over here. They think that it's all about bringing out boxes to battle. We're going to go back on our courageous history. And in the end of the day, that doesn't work. It's empty. Nothing's going to help you. It will be the same as bringing out at this point in time a Rubik's Cube. There's no Kedusha that it has in the way that they're treating it. That's what the Mishnah Chochmah says. That's how powerful it is. Now, let's turn around on the other side for a moment. So what happens? There's this moment. They think they're going to win. So what are the other camp things? So let's now return to the Pesukim for a moment. So now we return to the other side. So remember, the spectators don't know what's going on right now, right? We're on the Philistine side. It's 1-0 right now. Okay, so what's happening? The Philistine camp, per apostle Gvov to Tess. To Yudah, very quickly. Vayishmu plishtim, es kolatrua vayomer, mea kolatrua gdola azost, mamachane ivrim. What is this loud crying out that we hear among the Hebrews' camp? Vayayidu ki Aron Hashem boil amachane, and it became known that the Aron, the ark editor, came into the camp. They got very scared because they realized that the God of these Hebrews has come to the camp. This hasn't been the temperature up till now. This is a little dangerous. So now you can see they start getting scared. Who's going to save us from these powerful gods? These are the gods that we know historically that the Egyptians brought down the greatest empire of the time. Not just a country, an empire was destroyed by these gods, which they now bring into their camp. Now it sounds like a second voice emerges from that confusion, and the second voice turns around and says, "Listen to me, you Philistines." He says, you're gonna have to stand up, act like soldiers. Now let's go out into battle and fight them, right? So it sounds like there was two voices. Either it was like the Hamon Am, you know, and the populace, and then the officers sort of get on the soapbox now and says, You get back into rank kind of thing. That sounds like what's going on over here. We're gonna go into battle. And what does happen? And they went into battle, and there were 30,000 casualties. Right? This is now seven times as much as our original. And the Aaron is taken, and Chovni Pinchas died, which, by the way, of course, is the confirmation of Shmuel's curse, right, which happened the day that this terrible thing would happen, would be the day that the curse would start. And it was this was the confirmation of the Nevuah of the Ish Elokim we had 2 Prokim back, where he said that to Eli that the day that they die together is the day that it confirms that the curse for generations is going to come into effect. So everything is sort of come to a fore in one foul swoop over here. So let's just for a moment try to understand these Philistines. Okay, because now we've understood the Hebrew relationship to tragedy. Okay, so and they're perhaps their fallacy in understanding what went wrong. So what happens now in the Philistine mindset? Okay, because we have these two voices. In the beginning, it's a voice of confusion, and then there seems to be this resolute voice comes in and sort of takes over and manages to get them back into shape and put their boots back on and they go into battle. Right? That's what seems like it's going on over here. So we have to try to understand that. And I think the clue over here is in the way they describe the God of Israel. How is it that they describe the God of Israel? So the word they use. So they're describing the actions of that God, of the God of the Hebrews. But how are they describing him?
Many.
Okay, so you'll notice it's in plural, as Marge is pointing out, right?
Okay.
No, exactly. That's exactly. So that over here, it's not God, one God.
Right.
You know, it's not the God, capital G, of the Hebrews. What is it? It is their pantheon. They've got a whole team, right? So now, the team of the Hebrews has come out. You see, now the reason why that you can overcome that type of fear is very simple. You see, because in the end of the day, we as good old Philistines over here who live in the Gaza area, this is where the Philistines lived. It's always been a troublesome area for Israel. And by the way, the reason why the Romans named the area, the inhabitants of the land, they named it Palestine was because our age-old enemy was the Philistines. So the Romans did that as a kickback to us after Hadrian just quelled the rebellions. That's why we then sort of took the name on Palestine. So from this original history. So what happens over here? These Philistines who live with their happy pantheon, and they've got the rain god and the wind god and all kinds of god. They've got the fish god, because remember they're actually tribes which come from the Crete area. Okay, they came along the sea, so they have a fish god. We'll meet soon, and we have all these types of gods. So in the end of the day, if we have another nation which is fighting us, you know, they may have a powerful god, but maybe some of our gods can negotiate. You know, and we can sort of play strategically. If they have a bunch of gods. In the end of the day, we also have a bunch of gods. The danger over here is only if we understand that there is one God who controls all the rest of them. But they're not even willing to recognize that. You understand? They're not threatened by that. They just think, wow, this is the powerful set of gods who are more powerful than the set of gods than the Egyptians. But ultimately speaking, well, maybe we can make a better pact. We can have a better syndicate of gods against their gods. Because ultimately it's just about numbers and power. That's what it comes down to. And I think this is what part of it is over here. Is part of what Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to prove in Egypt was that it isn't a bunch of gods. It isn't a god who just controls the water or the frogs or the lice and it moves upwards, by the way, right? From the water to the land to the sky, right? It's not just a bunch of gods. It's the God who controls everything. That's what's happening over here, because otherwise you're not scared of them because, oh, well, that just happens to be that he's got a coalition of very good gods, right? And that's what the Philistines are thinking of here, which is why although they're scared, they're also able to negotiate that fear. So they jump into battle, and the terrible results ensue. Let's finish up over here with what goes on at the end of this battle for a moment. So we have in Pasuk Yud-Beis to Yud Zayin, we're told the following. Vayaratz ish binyamin imarachov yavosh shiloh bayamahu umadov kruim vadamor al roshoy. So we have this ish binyamin now runs back from the battle front. He comes to he's got torn garments. He's got earth on his head. By the way, those are descriptions of mourning. Not just battle. Not he must have obviously had a difficult time in the battle, but those are descriptions of mourning. So what happens is that he comes into the city, he must have missed Eli, because Eli's sitting at the entrance, and he tells the whole city, and everybody starts crying. He hears the people crying, because he obviously entered around the back, and Eli's crying, what happened over here? He comes and tells Eli. The problem over here in this pasuk is that he was mihar. He came fast. Because at this point in time, we're about to describe Eli's frailty. Eli ben Tishim v'shmona shana. He was 98 years old at this point. Okay, so rushing things is not a good thing at this age. V'einov koma, he completely couldn't see anymore. He'd lost eyesight. V'lo yachol lirois. And now he's told this terrible news. V'yomer ha'ish el Eli, anachi haba min ha'maracha, I'm returning from the front. V'ani min ha'maracha, nasti ha'yom, I ran, I escaped. He says, my son, tell me what happened. The people were smitten. There was a terrible plague. And your children were killed and the iron was taken. I mean, this is the worst thing that you could possibly hear in the universe. And Eli is so taken. Where's the next pasuk? When the Aaron was mentioned, upon hearing the news, he's so shaken, he falls backwards, and he breaks his neck and dies. Right there. So it was such terrible news that he dies. And furthermore, and his daughter-in-law, who's now pregnant from Pinchas, she immediately goes into early labor. The contractions start coming. And as she's dying, they told her, she wasn't able to answer when she had a child. And she names the child, you know, a lack of honor. Ichavod, a lack of honor. I always wondered if Ichavod Crane was, you know, a terrible, an unfortunate biblical mistake. Gola Kavod, El Hilokach Arono Elokim Ve'El Chamia Ve'El Chamia V'Isha. And because there's this lack of honor upon the destruction of the Aaron, or the capture of the Aaron and the killing of her father-in-law and husband. V'Tomer Gola Kavod Yisrael Kinilkach Arono Elokim. The honor has relieved Israel because the Aaron of God was taken. And there's a lot of things to think about over here in this really terrible ending to the story. Because this is really the curse of Eli has come into full circle. Everything that's been talked about, all the problems that the family came to its full conclusion over here in a really, really dramatically terrible way. One thing that's worth noting over here is that if you listen to her words very carefully, there's actually she has a beautiful symbiosis over here in describing the destruction. The way the Malbim describes this, let's focus on the Malbim just for a moment, and then we'll look backwards. The Malbim is the last source on page 8. She says, it is source 8 on page 2. It says, "Atikra la nar ichavod." She calls the lad lack of honor. Rotze lomar. This means to say, "Aye hakavod." Where is the honor? Ein kavod Yisrael. There's no longer honor among Israel. Uberad dvareo ki gola kavod Yisrael el hilokach. And because the honor was taken from Israel, kavonos. So what does she mean to say? Ki yesh shtei toras. There are two aspects of Torah. Torah shebichsav, mishkana ba'aron, the Torah shebalpeh, mishkana b'libo eschach me Yisrael. There's the written Torah, and then there is the oral Torah. The written Torah is manifest in the Torah scrolls that we have, but also in the luchos, right, which is to be found in the Aaron. And then there's the oral Torah, which is the tradition, which is transmitted not in books, but in people, right? Transmitted through education and what we're trying to perpetuate generation to generation. What she's mourning, says the Malbim, is over here, is both things. Is the fact that both the Aaron was taken, the Torah Shebichsav, and her father-in-law and husband, who were the transmitters, they were the leaders of generations of the Torah, Shebal Peh. And the ikavod means to say an absolute ikavod. There is nothing which is going to help them in any way over here. That's the destruction which is happening. Okay, but now last point which we come to. So that's a very beautiful description of why she sort of named this child as it is. We're going to meet ikavod later on, and we're going to deal with him and his family a little bit later. But here's the interesting question: what was it that really killed Eli? What was that really killed her? What were the news that really bothered them? So that the iron was taken. The Pesukim say explicitly it was when he heard that the iron was taken, right? If you look in the Pesukim, it says in Pasuk Yud Ches, Vayikils Kiros Aron Olakim. When he hears that the iron was taken. Now, there's a problem over there. There were numerous news items which are being described. Okay, there was his sons, Aaron, and all the people. We now have casualties of 34,000 upwards, right? So there's a lot at stake over here. Yet what really broke the camel's back in his perception was the Aaron, which really comes back to what we described beforehand. Part of the Achilles heel of Eli and his mindset, and perhaps the way he educated his children, was a very consistent focus on the temple of God, with perhaps eclipsing the focus on the people of God who came there, which is why it could yield a Pinchas and a Chofni, who would, in the end of the day, now misuse the people. But as long as perhaps somehow the Mishkan is preserved. So what happens over here? The tragedy which kills him is what was most important in his mind. You know, there's a description in the Gemara in Yuma which says that, you know, the way it used to be was that every morning they would allow the Kohanim to go and do what's called Trumas Hadeshim, which would mean to clean off the first pile of ashes off the Mizbeach from the previous day. So later on, what they did was they instituted a pius, which means there would be a lottery, and there would be a way of randomizing the choice of who would get it every morning. However, before that happened, the reason why they instituted that was because one morning there were two kohanim who were running to do it, and they ran up the ramp, and they were at the same time. And the one was so eager to get there, he pulled out a knife and killed his friend on the mizbeach in the base of Mikdash. And one of the Amoraim said, who witnessed this, said. There are the Tanaimus who witnessed this, said, you know, in the days where you found a homicide, you'd had to do an Egla Rufa, and the Zakenim used to say that we weren't responsible for this terrible death which happened. He says, who can bring the Egla Rufa over here? Meaning, what's happened to the people? Where is the sensitivity gone that what matters most is getting up to the top of the Mizbeach even if it's going to mean at the expense of somebody else's life? What's going on over here? There's a problem sometimes is that we sort of live in different components. We live in a ritual component and we live in a communal component. And sometimes we exclude one from the other. What's happening over here as well is this is the end of this terrible story, is where the ritual component, where the Mishkan-centric view is ultimately what kills Eli as well. He was a tremendous tzaddik. But part of the equation which was being eclipsed over here was the other part. There was 34,000 people who died as well. And here's how we come full circle, and this is how we end. Here's the beauty of it. Why did Hashem allow the Aaron to get captured in the first place? Coming back on the full circle. How could Hashem allow that to happen? How could Hashem allow the Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed? How could Hashem allow these places, his sanctuaries in this world, not to be protected?
Because we didn't respect it anymore.
Maybe so on one hand, we didn't respect it. So what's happening over here? Hashem saying, rather than having you decimated and destroyed, I'm going to allow an empty structure, a structure which you emptied of meaning, to be destroyed to save you. It's one step before you. It's always that way. It's like the way the Midrash describes in Eicha Rabbah, is that you have a king, and the king is terribly upset with his son, but he was about to marry his son off. He actually didn't rent a hall, he made a hall. He put draperies up, he made the meal, and the day before his son did something absolutely terrible. He was so angry with his son, he went and he destroyed the whole building, he bulldozed it, broke everything down. One of the courtiers stands there on the rubble and starts singing a song. And they say, how could you sing a song? He says, I'm singing a song because he didn't kill his son. He destroyed the building and he didn't kill the son. What's Hashem doing over here? Hashem says, you know, I'll send the Aaron. I'll send the box that you emptied of meaning into the Plishtim. Right? Because I'm saving you. It's the opposite exactly of what Eli's paradigm. Eli's paradigm was, it's always meaningful. The ritual, the sanctuary, the outer layers are so important. Hashem says, they're not important. You're more important. That's where the meaning is to be found. And it's the ultimate lesson which is being taught to us and to them. In the end of the day, and that's why we're learning it today. Anyways, the Mitzvah Shem will continue next week as we get back. This is the lowest point. We only have higher to go from here. Have a wonderful night.